This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com for the Limitless, the podcast between. This is first of two separate conversations with Jonathan Leatham. First conversation is about his new novel, The Feral Detective. Second conversation is When We Get Liminal. Okay, I think everything is running as it should be. At least here, if not in the world.
Nothing is running as it should be, I think is what you mean to say.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your new book.
Thanks.
And on the Motherless Brooklyn movie, that must be very exciting.
Yeah, it's still fairly unreal seeming, but there have been a couple of moments where I was persuaded to believe in its existence. Yeah. I guess I'll... confronted with its existence before too long, because I've spent a lot of money at this point.
Yeah, it seems to be underway. So let's start with the novel. I mean, let's stay focused on the novel today, I think, mm-hmm. as much as we can. I know we tend to go off in all kinds of areas, and I know my piece certainly did that, and I will refer to it, but hopefully we'll just start slow and see where it goes. So you started the Feral Detective prior to November 8th, 2016.
Well, I didn't begin the writing. I didn't have a single page of the book, but I'd been thinking about such a book and planning it at the levels that, you know, I'm able to plan in advance, which are very circumscribed in some ways, but I'd been planning it for about 2 years and assembling some of what I thought would be the ingredients or materials. You know, I'm always wrong, but that process of assembling is important, even though I'm wrong about what a book is going to be about or like, or how it's going to feel once I start writing it. So there was a kind of preparation that, you know, I'd sorry, there's a siren going past. Very rare here in Claremont. the kind of preparation I usually do, and which had me thinking I was about to begin the book in the late fall, and that it didn't have anything directly to do with the present moment. And then the present moment became sort of overwhelmingly strange, and the book I was planning to write seemed maybe beside the point in a way that a lot of things looked kind of paltry. You know, a lot of plans or artistic projects probably looked sort of flat at best to their makers around that time. And then I did a quick kind of somersault of injecting the book into the present framework, and that made it come back to life.
Right.
Was lucky for me that it seemed that it could be made to do that, because I might have been much slower to get back to work otherwise.
Right. So of course it makes me wonder, you know, how similar your original blueprint was, because in the piece that I wrote, I found myself focusing so much on the Donald Trump aspect.
Easy to imagine how it could all be read through that lens, and in a way I invite that now.
Yeah.
I think there's another sense in which the book is also a book that was that has an existence regardless of that material.
Well, so that begs the question for me, of course, is how much you were tapping into something already.
Yeah, that's a positive thought. I mean, it's not positive material that I would have been tapping into already, but yes, I think so. And I mean, I think that, you know, the other way in which the book was, and the way the book was in a sense provably prescient, which actually became kind of a a small series of awkward comic moments for me was that it, you know, while obviously it was planned somewhat, but then reconfigured after the election, and I began writing it in January, just around the time that the inauguration was. You know, the whole book is set in the whatever it is, sort of 5 days before and 5 days after the inauguration. I began writing it on January 1, as a kind of a spur to myself. I decided to begin a book on the first day of the year, no matter what, and continue it no matter what. And so it was begun only very slightly before its setting. And then, of course, because books are written more slowly than 10 days for me anyway, I was still writing early parts of it in the late spring, and that's when the Me Too moment sort of exploded. I can't prove the book was prescient of Trump. I like the suggestion you make that it is. I know it was prescient of Me Too because I was filling the book with little references, that some of which seemed so on the nose after the Me Too movement developed that I had to take them out because it would have seemed that I was shooting fish in a barrel. Phoebe originally worked for the New York radio host Leonard Lopate in the book. She, you know, I have her still working at public radio for a time, but I had a very specific job where she worked under Lopate. And then in mid-spring, after I'd already committed this, I'd made this decision and committed it to the page, Lopate was fired. And I have her interning at the Paris Review, and then, you know, the Paris Review exploded. And so I had to keep taking things out because it would have seemed I was following this, you know, in a kind of almost gratuitous way. What would you say, beating dead horses.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd accidentally predicted them, and that atmosphere, I think, of the book is important. You know, I mean, it's and very strongly interrelated to the election.
Because the other thing you, I suppose, want to avoid is being too topical, because then you're just easily dated. It's too restricted to specifics.
Right. I mean, dated is one fear, but also that it will just become distractingly. It will seem distractingly pegged in a journalistic way. Even if it gives you a little kind of momentary thrill of recognition, you'll think, well, that's, you know, it's just too easy. That's what you turn to, you know, whatever your chosen website is, that's what you go to, you know,
exactly,
Slate,
yeah,
or Daily Cause for. It's not what you open a novel for.
Yeah, for political commentary, social commentary. Yeah. And what I became aware of writing my response to your novel, which is, I think, the best description of what it is. Whenever I seem to write about your books, they're less reviews than responses. However close they are to a real dialogue is really hard to say, except by checking with you. But what it brought home to me is, and maybe this is a subtle distinction between prescience and just tuning into the zeitgeist and seeing the undercurrents, that it helped me to see, and I'd already been dimly aware of it, of the sort of archetypal resonance of a character like Trump, like what he represents in the collective psyche, particularly the collective American psyche.
Yeah. Well, and what he participates in as in the collective psyche, and also the peculiar ways in which he advances the image or makes it baroque or makes it curdle into something slightly new. But you have to understand the participation in the archetype before you can also appreciate the strange flourishes or baroque excesses that mark his version of it, you know? I mean, Greil Marcus equated Bill Clinton with Elvis Presley. And of course we all understand the equation of Ronald Reagan with a cowboy, but the extent to which, you know, this American figurehead is kind of always fulfilling certain very archetypal positions, you know, in the dream, in the fantasy, and then how we what we demand of them, you know, what was I reading? Very wonderfully pissy remarks by Jarrett Kobeck. Have you read Jarrett Kobeck yet?
You might be
intrigued by him. He got some notoriety with a self-published book called Why I Hate the Internet, or I'll send you a link to it. His last name is Kobeck, and he's a very mordant provocateur, but he was talking about how the way people remain shockable, you know, by the fact that the president could be so, you know, have such bad table manners. And he says, you know, what we require in our remote control killer of brown people with digitally operated airplanes is that they have grace and table manners, and that they dress the proper, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a tremendous amount of difficulty. Your piece is suggestive of this. I kept myself from reading it too carefully. I wanted to respond to you rather than the piece, so I sort of read it with my hand over one eye. But you know, one of my other early readers for the book said that she was concerned that Phoebe seemed politically naive to her, in her expectation that, you know, this was the crucial juncture. And I didn't disagree. I think that it's about the pressure that that was imminent, and that the contradictions that were suppressed behind the idea of the kind of neoliberal continuity. I don't think, in many ways, I don't think our situation would be any better had Hillary Clinton prevailed, and perhaps not even had, you know, Bernie Sanders prevailed. That it is about things that predate Trump and predate or that transcend the matter of who is occupying the office of the presidency, and that fixating on that image is a diversion to a large extent. But then again, Phoebe's female, and I think it was a different kind of disaster on the level of the history of gender politics, or the history of feminism, or the history of the exposure of the patriarchy. And so on the one hand, in terms of a kind of political policy nightmare, it's really just a disambiguation or a de-sublimation of what was already before us. But on the level of the refusal of the image of the female candidate, it was a blindsiding, you know, reality received a kind of a drone attack from nowhere in the middle of what was meant to be a kind of wedding party for humanity, right? So it's both new and old stuff. It's both, you know, business as usual and a startling repudiation or backlash.
Or at least people received it that way. But on the other hand, it was Hillary, you know, as a female world leader, wouldn't really have been new for anyone who, particularly myself, grew up in Britain under Margaret Thatcher.
Right, that's fair. And you know, I mean, the fact that we got to dally with Obama gets his completely unearned Nobel Peace Prize just for thrilling the world with the idea that America might actually be at the forefront of a kind of emancipatory post-racial moment, and it's quite humiliating to be reminded, but it's so obviously true, as you so casually and easily do it, that we only got that one little jolt of getting to pretend that we, because yes, of course, there's in India and England and any number of other places have accepted the possibility of female power, and of course, power turns out to be power in the traditional sense when it's once it crosses that gender boundary. But the symbolic fantasy of a kind of another, what would you call it, kind of crescendo of egalitarianism by electing a woman to the presidency of the United States was a shattering repudiation for people who felt invested in that part of it. And, in a way, its symbolic elements were quite beautifully isolated by the fact that Hillary was so otherwise such a ordinary neoliberal hawk.
Right. And not especially womanly, really, in terms of, I don't necessarily want to get pulled into down the political rabbit hole, because there's obviously, well, it's beyond either of our scope, but also it'll take us further and further away from the novel. But staying on this question, the female avatar, how early did you know that you were going to write a first-person female character?
Well, it was as elemental to the conception of the book as my certainty that I could write a book, because I'd been thinking about ferality. Hmm. Various ways for quite a while before centering it and having an idea of how I wanted to isolate it. One reason it was a problematically baggy it was an idea that centered my interest, but also I couldn't find the edges of that interest. It was too general. Was that I think in a way I have already written about ferality, that in a way urban feral children are the subject somewhat Motherless Brooklyn, certainly Fortress of Solitude, and that then moving that image of the feral child to Mars is the part of the subject of Girl in Landscape, and it's an image of enormous identification for me, both in its corniest archetypes, Tarzan and Mowgli, and then also in the specific peculiar stories of, Caspar Hauser and the tragedy of what a genuine feral child tends to actually be like when it enters into the news cycle, which happens every once in a while. And so I didn't know how to center it. And in that way, it reminded me of my interest in the language disruptions, the neurological disruptions of Tourette's, because it was such a intricate identification and one I felt I'd already been participating in with my kind of the characters who talk crazy in the books that precede Motherless Brooklyn. And so I thought, almost in a very mechanistic way, I thought, well, how did I handle this material that's too inextricable from my preoccupations already to find the edges of? I handled it by making a kind of a funny detective. So maybe I'll make a funny feral detective. So then I'd gotten that far into the idea, and I was centered on this idea that there would be a detective who'd been a feral child, but I couldn't get that off the ground. It still wasn't really an idea that I believed in for a book, until the moment that I had this next thought, which is, oh, I'm not going to do him in his first person. I'm going to do a hard-boiled first person, but it will be the client. You know, I mean, the classic hardboiled detective story starts when the woman walks into the detective's office and engages him in the case. And I like those formalities. It's like a sonnet. It's like has a precision, you know, that as with other genre, exoskeletal structures, it gives you this wonderful thing to play against. It's like being a songwriter and insisting that you're going to do verse, chorus, bridge, you know, verse, chorus. You know where you are. And so it can organize chaotic material and also just give you the pleasure of engagement with these tenacious formal structures. So I thought, I'll do the hard-boiled detective scene in its pure sense. The woman walks into the office, except what's funny about that scene is that you always stay with the detective. And the woman is sort of parked. She has to wait for him to call and say what's happening in the case. Where is that woman during that time? I mean, in some stories, she's secretly the problem. She's the femme fatale, so she's off doing other skullduggery. But in many cases, her existence seems to just go into kind of a neutral mode. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be funny to walk out of the room with the client instead of staying with the detective and go to the hotel and wait for the detective to call? You know, what would that do to a book? Mm-hmm. So suddenly I was with Phoebe instead, and I realized that now it's a book. It was when I invented her and the notion of giving the hard-boiled first person to the client instead of the detective, and letting Heist remain a kind of a figure of projection and puzzlement. You know, one thing I did see reading your piece through my fingers. Was you said that Heist really remains a kind of a cipher figure or like a black hole. And I think that's true. I mean, I honestly might at some level have had a desire to uncover him further, but the book itself didn't turn out to be a procedure that made that happen. And then I realized I could accept that he, you know, there's the epigraph in the book, Dawn Powell, what motive does this man have for having a motive? And I don't think I answered the epigraph's question. I mean, in a way, he's a romantic figure of fantasy. He's a gentle Heathcliff or something, who, you know, who's you know, who the book and the narrator can be in love with without solving. And in that sense, it's a very traditional romantic book as well as a traditional detective story. But the book was doing enough because Phoebe became complex and interesting enough to me, and the space of the kind of both allegorical and real space of the desert became substantial to me in a way that made a book even where a Heist was stuck in the middle distance in a way.
It's like you took the genre or the narrative out of its usual milieu, because a detective story that takes place in the mountains and the wilderness, well, it loses, you know, the usual reference points that we associate with the detective story. And it didn't really feel like a detective story to me, even though it's called The Feral Detective and there's a detective in there and they're trying to solve a case. It didn't have that feel to me, and it seems as though you're actually splicing two genres there as well. One, the detective, and the other is like the sort of something wild, or the, you know, the discovery of the
That's good. Of course, it's a road movie. You know, it's like I mean, Something Wild is a possible reference or but you know, one of the other things that was lurking in this book for me was I'd been reading both Tolkien and Philip Pullman aloud to my children. And the sense of this space of figures just crossing landscape looking for things, that it was about, it was partly just, I mean, that genre doesn't have a name, but the sense that there was something so elemental in those narratives, you know, that in a way the entire trilogy in both cases is just this sort of long walk across space. And I wanted to put these characters into a relation to planetary space, to the you know, because of the way the desert isolates and heightens certain definitions, you know, it turns people into allegorical figures because of the emptiness around them. And so there was a, you know, yeah, of course I started with the beginning of a detective story, and then I subtracted things. I subtracted the city. And, you know, I mean, almost in a way that's almost like a joke, I subtracted the houses. The people are living in a unbuilt city in the desert, you know, in bare space. And but I also wrote a novel about the election, and I subtracted the election because most people that she meets don't know that anything happened that's defining or important or should matter to them. And so it's a place, you know, the desert and the searching across that space for this lost other who may be kind of a version of a lost self. It's really a book about Phoebe beholding herself in plain space and stripped of expectations or contexts that gave her consoling things to define herself against.
One of the things I say in my piece, and I'm, as of a lot of the stuff I wrote in there, I'm not 100% sure of it. It's very sort of intuitive, kind of groping around my own impressions of the novel. But one of the things was that I felt as though I was hearing closer to your own voice than in other fictions. That somehow you were somehow writing as a female had freed you up in terms of expressing your own perspective.
That's interesting. It may be true in some places. I mean, that first person that I conjured for her was very freeing, certainly, and I wrote the book rapidly, partly because of the simple and impulsive and compressed narrative structure, you know, one short action of moving through space to look for someone followed by another. But the voice was very compulsive for me and enjoyable, and so there are probably ways in which I did feel closely identified to it, not to specifics, obviously not to the gender specific, but to the spirit of it. Also paradoxically, I'd say getting to be Phoebe was a relief from being me, and it was an enjoyable book that I wrote quickly, partly because I was so relieved of thinking as myself because I invented someone who I liked spending time with who was speaking instead of me. So both what you say and its opposite, I think.
Well, do you think that it allowed you to create some distance between yourself and your own feelings around the election?
Well, sure. I mean, it was a deliberate choice to identify with people who were more shocked than I was. I mean, I'm one of the only people I know who was given a really definite, terrifyingly definite warning by someone who I was inclined to believe, because Adam Curtis told me 6 months before Trump was elected that I shouldn't fail to take him seriously, that he thought he was going to win. And I thought he was joking and made him repeat it several times. And he said, oh no, I think he's going to win. And I just sat with that, and I didn't even repeat it to people because I knew it would be too upsetting. Hmm. I should have repeated it to people. And that was Adam Curtis. Yeah. So, needless to say, probably I pulled the lever for Hillary, but I was also perhaps predictably and maybe irritatingly to some, I was a Bernie bro. Not that I saw him as flawless, but I had a horse in the race who was already gone, you know? Hmm. And that was as much about the simple embrace of the word socialism, and also about other sentimental characteristics that he reminded me of the part of my New York Jewish family that, you know, he was endearing to me. And I root for the underdogs. It's like rooting for the Mets to have been a Bernie bro. It isn't all about some absolute faith in his capacities, but any more than I have faith in the capacity of the New York Mets. So I wasn't in Phoebe's position vis-a-vis the election. And I don't say that to distance myself from her naivete, because I actually find the power of her disappointment deeply meaningful. And the, you know, the results important, the results of that disenchantment quite important. But it's not exactly my position that she's occupying.
Why you wait for me to anoint you? I haven't got a clue what I'm supposed to do, and there's no direction I can point you. Maybe now you see it was never me. I was a construct of your contusion, desperate to believe what you hoped to be, but it only led to confusion. Expectations, they sometimes burn you, and they spurn the moves you make. So walk away from your conclusions, and your illusions soon will fade. Yes, I am. I'm doing what I can, and just like you, I am broken. I'm trying to make a stand in my house of sand, and my eyes once shut now are open.
you know, one of the things that I've been grappling with, both in, you know, where I live now in Southern California, suburban sprawl, and in not being in New York City, and then in my writing, you know, I've just now chosen this atmosphere here to write about in the desert, and I'm writing, my next book is written about rural Maine, which is a place that's become very important to me, but has in a sense nothing in common with this landscape except the problem I'm about to describe, which is the absence of Black people. The utter absence, which can be very discouraging for me, and it's discouraging for me to end up conceiving books that where that absence is sort of necessitated by the setting and the material. And one way I inoculated myself against this, well, that kind of demoralization, you know, oh, look, here I am, the person who wrote Cicero Lookins and the person who wrote Mingus Rood and the person who wrote Barrett Rood Jr. And now I haven't, you know, there's no one in the last, you know, 5 years of my fiction writing within shouting distance who's, you know, I mean, there's a little kind of disconsolate nod to diversity at the end of Gambler's Anatomy in Berkeley, but the character who leads you into that space is so disassociated that he's unable to identify with any other human beings by the end of the book. And so I felt very, you know, probably, well, demoralized, and also in a sense potentially defensive, because instead of shoring up my in this time when the question of you know, identification, empathy versus appropriation of identity in the arts is so fraught, and I really feel that I developed my capacity to compassionately write across racial difference, and it would maybe be an important thing to continue to embody that. I happen to have, my material and my circumstance have sort of stranded me. But then again, Samuel Delaney, who's a huge teacher for me, it's different from being an influence, which he is as well, but he's, because of his essays on writerly practice and also the fact that I've known him and listened to him and seen him interviewed, and he's a teacher for me. And there's a remark somewhere, I wish I had isolated it so I could quote it exactly, where he, you know, so here he is, a gay African American, also a science fiction writer, and also a leftist, and so, you know, working from all kinds of margins that don't happen to be that of gender. And in this remark, he says that he thinks finally that the first place, the most the sort of point of origin for self versus other as a power relation is gender. That, you know, men looking at women and saying, other person, not as much as me, not as their subjectivity, not as important, their privilege is not as important. That he, you know, as much as he's committed to these other forms of division and that need to be, you know, that need restorative justice, that gender is the baseline condition for supremacies in our world. And so I thought, well, okay, if I'm at least at the heart of that work in my writing, I can perhaps excuse myself from this other front for the moment. And so, you know, doing, yeah, I didn't see it as a brazen political decision. I saw it was emerged. It was an emergent artistic decision to write from Phoebe's point of view in first person, but also to make the book so much a kind of a allegory of gender difference. But I was glad that I'd arrived there.
Hmm.
You know, yeah, it mattered to me to be doing it.
So it's potential minefield here. I mean, before we spoke, I sent you, I mentioned I've been writing about transgender. And mm-hmm. one of the things I discovered writing about transgender is that the word gender is a relatively new invention in its current meaning. Like, it just used to belong to language, different between gender nouns, and that it was actually coined, the John Money Institute, as a means to rationalize sexual reassignment surgery, because they recognized there was no way to change anybody's sex. So this has kind of led me, for me, it's a very refreshing position to find myself in, or a sort of ground that I've discovered, that the whole notion of gender is a contrivance of language, like linguistic engineering. Because there is no thing that called gender that relates to human beings outside of the social construct, of course, which is what feminism was about, like trying to free us from gender, you know, from the restrictions of the imposition of a social, you know, categorization that we'd term gender.
Yeah.
So then we're in a very strange liminal time in history, because the transgender thing is actually reasserting the power of gender in these very weird ways, which is why there's this now cultural war between feminism and transgender, which this is a whole rabbit hole. We don't want to get sucked into that.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty overwhelming to
even
touch on.
It is. Yeah, since it's all very Dickian. I mean, I always feel as though Philip K. Dick haunts our conversations, because that was the point of our meeting, and I feel it's in many ways the strongest correlation between us, the strongest sympathy. Like, we both like Talking Heads, and we both like Marvel superheroes, but those are relatively superficial, as great as they are, compared to Dick.
I dug out my Ubik shirt for you today.
Yeah. You're wearing the colors.
Yeah, I'm wearing the colors.
So yeah, it's been a bit of periphery in my awareness throughout this conversation, all the different ways in which we seem to be living in a simulacrum of reality, and like when you're talking about Hillary and Trump and the virtue, we didn't say virtue signaling, but the ideological, the superficial victory of a half black president and a half female potential president and so on, that it's all, there's a kind of theatrical aspect to all of this.
Yeah.
Oh, I had a continued thing there. Well, the gender thing, of course, is very Dickian, in the sense of this shifting definitions of reality that we're trying to navigate. Well, I was thinking in terms of the feral thing, like what, because the ferality, which you particularly associate with feral children, cause of course animals are feral too, that overlaps with autism, because many, you know, autistic children are extreme. The parallels between that and feral children are strong, and you have a very long-term kind of interest or affinity for the autistic experience, and Motherless Brooklyn, the Tourette's syndrome, the various autistic characters throughout your fiction. So, of course, where I'm inclined to go is, well, what is it in Jonathan that he's trying to own in himself? Like, what is it? What's the appeal of ferality? And this might sound, I mean, you can answer it and deny it or whatever, or confirm it, or but both, that there's something in you that wants to get out and to be liberated.
Well, I'm sure that's true. But also, I mean, thinking of it as a kind of topical interest, it's both individual and collective in terms of its signification in identity that interests me, because it's, you know, in a way, America is a collectively feral nation, you know, that's our relation to the history of nations is to use our unique self-invention to be and our the freakish geographical reality of the exploitable resource and the unbounded frontier of Western expansion to kind of go away from the family of of Enlightenment nations into the wild, and then claim this sort of doubleness, to be of and not of, which then also corresponds to the figure in masculinity that fascinates and perplexes me for its a potential for both creative and abusive power, which is the half affiliated, the Humphrey Bogart, the Han Solo, the
Easton Edwards,
the John Wayne, right? Who's capable of rescuing civilization but is ambivalent about its shackles and sets back off into the territory after enacting the rescue, or has to be, has to negotiate this ambivalence, which is also ambivalence, of course, about families and about affiliation, nurture, So it's also about parents and children, and ferality goes down to that core. I mean, who is Humphrey Bogart's mother? Does he ever call? The question is a very strange one.
Yeah.
He's a disparented image.
Hmm. Right.
Who raised him? Who raised the detective in The Big Sleep? Hmm. There used to be a woman in Berkeley who would come to every reading. That she was in a very Berkeley way, she was a sort of a official crazy person with an official role. She would sit in the front row at Cody's Books, and I knew this because I would go to see different writers who I was interested in at that time come, Paul Auster or Martin Amis come, and she would sit rather angrily through their reading and have her hand up first to ask the first question. And the first question she'd ask every time was, "What does your mother think of your books?" Mm-hmm. It was always presented as sort of like indictment, So then when it became my turn and I was finally published and I gave a reading at Cody's, sure enough, there she was in the front row. And she had her hand up, and I called on her knowing what her question would be. She said, "What does your mother think of this book?" And I said, "Well, my mother died when I was young." And she got very disconcerted and confused. But, orphanhood, ferality, masculine, heroic non-affiliation. I mean, I don't think it's that, and also, right, neurological disaffiliation, autism, the character who is the freak of circumstance and embraces it, the paradoxes of the superhero, who's both an outcast and a savior, both of the society and has a secret identity and is a fugitive within the society. All of these things that are emblems of how identity constructs itself in a society such as ours that have interested me can also be called up in this image of the feral, although we associate it with natural environments and animals, which should seem like it's not my subject, that I'm a writer of cities and urbanities and civilizations and class, structures. But the feral is actually not of the wild. The feral is of the edge.
Liminal, yeah.
They're even Mowgli, you know, sort of goes and looks at the people living right at the edge of the forest. That the wilds in the Jungle Book are bounded very strictly by the presence of the social.
So is the word feral, was it coined for human beings in that way?
I didn't research the word in that sense. That would be quite interesting, just as you spoke of gender now. I can't account for it.
Yeah, it's a great word. With that, the archetype you're referring to, the John Wayne, the Clint Eastwood, the Western hero archetype, which is obviously so central to the American self-image, that, and this comes up in True Detective. Did you see True Detective season 2, by the way? Was there any reference there?
I did, yeah. I was a little more skeptical of it than you, but that writer's energies are very enthralling and strange. I'm the weird person who started with season 2. I never saw season 1, so I should go back and look at that.
Okay, well, that was what I was actually referencing. I just wanted to ask about season 2 because I like to champion it. But in season 1, there's a line there about how we need to be bad men to protect the community from worse men than us.
Right. That's the central thing. That's like a desublimation of the John Wayne figure in like something like The Searchers.
Yeah.
Who, you know, when he comes between the settlers and the Native Americans, the Indians, he does so on the principle that he knows and is complicit with the ungodly ferocity of the natives in a way that he's protecting everyone from. And it emerges, I mean, I think between the lines in that movie, that he's an unrepentant Confederate soldier as well. He wasn't there at the surrender, he says.
Right.
Well, if you weren't there at the surrender, then you're still in the war. So he's a figure, right, like Japanese soldiers on the islands, you know, still fighting World War II deep into the 1970s.
Right.
Another kind of ferality is the traumatized soldier who's returned from the battlefront to civilization, but is...
Ooh, Travis Bickle, yeah.
Yeah, Travis Bickle, exactly, yeah. The shell-shocked veterans of World War I, you know, and again, I'll remind you, as I must have done once before, that the secret identity lurking just under the skin of the hard-boiled detective is that he is a returning World War I veteran. He wears a trench coat. He's returned from trench warfare.
Hmm.
That's why he's unsuitable for conventional romantic attachment, and why he has special powers that enable him to cut across the hypocrisies of the social order, because his trauma is his superpower.
Right. Oh God, that again. We'll be right back. Yeah, that's really interesting. And so the difference between a Western hero and a detective, hardboiled detective fiction hero, ones I haven't really considered. So that's a very interesting area, I think, because the point I was getting to about the Western hero, the archetypal traditional understanding is, as you're saying, that he's not part of the community, but he can protect the community insofar as he's more aligned and affiliated or sympathetic with the thing that's threatening the community. Right. So you even see this in a movie like Heat. You know, the cop played by Al Pacino is really much closer to the criminal played by Robert De Niro than he is to his wife or his family or anything like that. There's this affinity that makes him efficient to actually, you know, hunt down his prey. A predator takes a thief to catch a thief, takes a predator to catch a predator, right? So, but the problem then for the hero is that once he's served his function, as in the searches, he can't remain because he then becomes the threat.
Yeah.
Right? So with the hardboiled detective, and I brought this up in my piece about you, the Chandler line, a man who is not mean must walk down these mean streets. It's closer to the knight, isn't it? The detective. He's closer to the kind of archetypal knight, like you're saying, he can't have sexual relations. He's got to actually be purer than the forces that he's detecting and exposing.
Right. Well, and yes, and you know, that's the image that I was fooling around with from the very beginning with Gun with Occasional Music, where he's actually been, to take it back to your word, he's been misgendered. You know, I don't know if you remember that about the character in my first novel, but
no.
He's undergone what was meant to be a kind of kinky, temporary sexual reassignment, where you experience the sex as the other. Mm. So his genitalia give him the opposite signal, opposite sensation.
Oh.
And it's for him, it became accidentally permanent and traumatic, and he's basically opted out of the whole.
Oh no, I didn't know that. So, because I actually haven't read that one, so it's a bit like bookending now, that novel with your current one.
Yeah, but you know, and the other thing you could see about Heist, to take it back to the specifics of Feral Detective, and just to think aloud about it in a way I hadn't, is that he's, you know, so she walks in looking for Humphrey Bogart, and because she's in the West and is of the East, she has to kind of immediately adjust her framing and start to wonder if what she's got for her trouble isn't Bogart, but sort of more like Clint Eastwood or John Wayne. Mm. But what he is to himself is part of a, you know, he was meant to be the king of the bears. He's a member of a masculine cult of ritual violence and abduction. Mm. Who has essentially sought peace in a kind of Bartleby the Scrivener gesture. He would prefer not to.
Right.
He's hiding.
Right. So do you identify with that then?
What's that? Would I identify with that?
Yeah, I mean, I just got a flashed on. Okay, so that's Latham's secret.
Here, I'm going to show you this book that I'm staring at. Can you see the title?
Yeah, Where Men Hide.
And the weird thing about this book is that I've been tremendously interested in it ever since I bought it because of the power of that title. And I have, and it's basically a book about garages and man caves.
Right.
And then you can look at my office, right? Yeah. All around me here, you're in my man cave with your camera. And I've never read the book. It's as if I'm afraid of it. I've had it for about 15 years on my shelf, in my to be read shelf right here.
Right.
Yes, you've caught me. I'm trying to wait out the battle in my hiding place, my detective's office, with my possum companion, and not get dislodged into the fray.
Because that's
Heist did it for me, but I don't want to have to do it.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that's really one of the dangers of being a writer, is one can always wear a condom, so to speak, in life, always have, you know, safe experiences of the other with these literary avatars. And I have to say, you know, we probably have to wind up now, and hopefully we can pick it up, but it's a sensitive thing for me, having the relationship with you that I have is that I feel as though I actually wander the wilderness on the margins as a, you know, relatively unknown rider and with no family and no real job except the thrift store, you know, nothing to protect in that regard. Like, I can write about transgender, I can write about what the hell I want, I can be as politically incorrect as I want, and confront some of the Dickian underlayers of reality, as you know I do, but that wouldn't be safe for you. It really wouldn't. So then I feel as though that's why I use that term radioactive, although actually I had a slightly different meaning, but I do feel as though I have to be careful with how I relate to you, because I don't want to, you know, shine too much light on your cave.
I think that your thinking about my work has been influential on my work, and it probably is influencing some people's interpretation of my work. So I think it is radioactive, but I don't feel endangered by it. So in your formulation, I want to resist the idea that my operations mostly proceed from within a cordon of cautions that I've taken. You know, I might just be more conventional than you wish I was.
Well, I had to say,
rather than more careful, I might just be more conventional.
Yeah, I know, and I have to wonder. I mean, that was one question I wanted to ask about my piece, but maybe you'd need to read it again to answer. But you know, how much am I projecting here? Because I'm thinking that I'm seeing hidden meanings, and whenever I write about you, I'm discovering what I think are hidden treasures and coded meanings and stuff. But there's obviously a perennial question. Maybe I'm projecting a lot of this stuff.
Well, I think of a book, maybe particularly a book like Feral Detective, as inviting hidden meanings into its space. It's not an either or of projection. You know, oh, it's there, or oh, it's not there, and you projected it in. It might be that the book is designed as a form of aperture, which only comes to life by that kind of desire being applied to it, and that I've written it as a net for those projections.
Right, and that, but if so, if that was, I mean, if there really was a dialogue between the reader and the writer, which I feel there has been with you, I mean, that's how it all began anyway, then the what might be projections might actually turn out to be intuitive intimations of your own unconscious process.
Absolutely, completions of the work.
Yeah.
Acts of completion. Yeah. I mean, one thing that an editor said about this book was that it seemed I was moving towards a more symbolist style, and I think that pleased me, even though I think there was an expression. It was meant neutrally, not as praise. Like, oh, look at this attainment. It was just a neutral observation by an editor who, in some ways, I think was also expressing some reservations, or had yet decided whether they thought this was a major success for me or a transitional work or whatever. But I took it as a description, in a way, of this greater accomplishment on the level of opening the book to interpretive space. That it was, have we talked about that film of people theorizing about Kubrick's The Shining, Room 238,
237? Yeah, I think we have.
You know, I think that you know, I know you're Kubrick is a real problem for you, but I think that one of the things that I like about it, which I could also say I like about, you know, Fear of Music, is, you know, that the better Kubrick films, the ones that I go to again and again, and The Shining, unexpectedly, given how I first felt about it, has been one of those. Yeah. Is that, and Eyes Wide Shut is very much one of these too, is that they seem to become vehicles for dreaming and thinking and theorizing in a way that's got it. They have exaggerated properties for this, and I would love to create work that. I mean, it's, I don't know from my side whether that's really becoming more the case, or whether it's the case at all, or the comparison is just a fatuous self-flattery on my part. But anyway, that was how I took this editor using the unusual word of symbolist to puzzle over Feral Detective. Was I thought maybe I like that because that catches that's someone's slightly hesitant description of this projection inviting capacity that I'm interested in.
Right. Well, it's one of the things that I was exploring with the Kubrickon was to what extent was Kubrick aware of that possibility and seeding it in his audiences so that they would begin to look at his works more and more with that kind of eye, and then that would amplify the signal. And I think I've observed that with you, because I don't read I don't read novels by anyone but Jonathan Lethem, actually, because I just don't read fiction anymore. But even if I did, I read a novel by you in a very different way, because we have this on again, off again dialogue. So so I can't even say myself, I'm not a good control, because I'm not sure how much I'm finding things I wouldn't find and even planting them in there.
Right.
Because I'm reading on that level, but that's maybe a moot question anyway, because every writer has an unconscious, and the unconscious is always trying to communicate something through symbols. So then I think it comes down to this thing I read about with the mirror neurons, is the brain state. You know, what brain state are you in when you're writing that novel? Obviously only you can know that, but I think because you and I have a dialogue, I'm more adept at tuning into your brain state when I'm reading it, because I'm already connected to you. So, and what I get from your novels, and I was more aware of it, more conscious of it this time, is, oh, well, Ethan seems to be working on a problem here. And it's more than just the problem of finishing the novel. But again, am I projecting that? Because that's how I approach things as a writer. Yeah, I'm always working on a problem.
That description also sounds like another, I mean, intended neutrally. It's only a tentative and neutral description, but it suggests to me a success that I would embrace, that it should feel that. though you might not be able to name the problem exactly, and I might not be able to name the problem exactly, that the book has that that atmosphere and invites that sensation in your reading. So before we wind up, which I should do other things today, I wanted to say that I think that you're going to be very interested in this book I'm writing about Maine next, which in some ways I think very loosely I might say is going to be like a rural chronic city.
That seems like a contradiction in terms.
Yes, I know. but I think that's the book of mine that this one is in dialogue with.
Oh, nice. Well, that does remain for me the philosopher's stone of the Lethem's opus so far, anyway.
I like that term.
Yeah,
that's good.
My wife is the same way.
Stunning.
Sorry, say again.
Sounds like Colin Wilson.
What does? Which part?
Well, calling a book the Philosopher's Stone of a given writer's opus just sounds very. I think he actually has a novel, Colin Wilson, called The Philosopher's Stone. So it's a pretty direct association. Yeah.
Were you consciously referencing Chinatown, by the way, in the book? Was that how conscious was that?
That's a very influential, hard-boiled text for me, and I mean that one is in there sort of by just quite automatically as it's in my first novel, Gun With Occasional Music, maybe a little bit less so Motherless Brooklyn of the three detective novels. But ironically, the one thing I know about the Edward Norton adaptation of Motherless Brooklyn, about which I know very, very little, I've never read the script, is that he was obsessed with Chinatown and moved the material of Motherless Brooklyn strongly in the direction of civic and urban development scandal, because he wanted to emulate Chinatown directly.
All right, he hasn't changed it to Motherless Los Angeles, though.
No, it's not been moved from New York, but he's adopted. I don't know if you know enough about the history of New York to know about the kind of disputes, famous disputes around Robert Moses, the great developer of freeway systems. He's put a quasi Robert Moses character in there, who's very much analogous to the Noah Cross figure, the water developer in Chinatown.
Right.
And so there's a gravitational pull that Chinatown has as a narrative that has affected now all three of my.
Oh, so that's very zeitgeisty then, because I was thinking more thematically. I mean, obviously there's parallels with the genre, but with Noah Cross is a kind of Trumpian figure.
Of course, absolutely. It's a Trump image,
and,
yeah.
And again, the reverse Beauty and the Beast thing, which I haven't quite formulated rationally, but that was intuitive. It felt as though what you were doing was exploring the Beauty and the Beast myth in new ways, and Chinatown can also be seen as an inversion of that, the beast that devours the beauty.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
To be continued, perhaps, I hope.
All right, well, we'll look for a sequel.
That's the end of my first conversation with Jonathan Lethem, and the second conversation I had is very different. It was much more exploratory, much more liminalist, and I do recommend listeners check that one out. It will be up this coming Saturday, the 20th of October. Next week's Liminalist is with James Howard Kunstler. You can also hear me talking to Jim over at his website, kunstler.com. There's an accompanying essay on Jonathan Lethem's... There's an accompanying essay on Jonathan Lethem's Feral Detective, which I've linked to at my blog. If you haven't seen it already, it's at Conatus News. It's called The Monster in the Mirror, Donald Trump and the Disease of Confidence. Okay, that's it for this week. Encourage listeners to participate in this project by commenting at the blog and the podcast, buying my books, reviewing them even, or donating if you like via PayPal and the widget at the website at horticulture.com. Till next week.